I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 25th of June. Our guest this hour is going to challenge Americans' views of democratic government. He writes, despite Abraham Lincoln's vision that our government is of the people, by the people, and for the people, there is little evidence that the most important outcomes of the policy political process follow uniformly from the opinions of the American public or their expression in elections. So what do we look at when we look at who is important in making policy decisions? A look at 60 years of domestic policy history is found in Matt Grossman's latest book. It is Artists of the Possible, Governing Networks and American Policy Change Since 1945. Professor Grossman looked at so much material in compiling this book. It covers federal domestic policy making since 1945, and the data originates from 268 sources of policy history. Most of those are books. Sources all cover at least 10 years of policy making since 1945 in one of 14 domestic policy issue areas. It also records every individual and organization that historians credit with policy change, and that's 1,306 actors. So it's a very, very complete book and highly interesting. Matt is our guest this hour, author of the book, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Michigan State University. Research concerns American politics and policy making, particularly interest group representation and influence, political networks, campaigns, and federal policy change in the U.S. His first book was Not-So-Special Interests, Interest Groups, Public Representation, and American Governance. For you to join the conversation, here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Matt Grossman, thank you for being with us again. Nice to have you on the air.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Oh, you did a lot of work for this one. Didn't you? I mean, this is a huge undertaking, sir.
Well, I had quite a bit of help from our research assistants here at Michigan State, and of course the authors who originally tracked each of these policy areas. So really I'm just trying to compile and draw from all of the evidence that policy historians have gathered.
And you picked this 60-year period for what reason? Is it that it was the norm that we got a middling amount of legislation, or was this really a glorious time in American policymaking?
Well, the post-war era is sort of a nice cutoff for what we think of as contemporary policymaking, and I wanted to go as close to the present as possible and try to use some examples from the present, but it takes a little bit of time for the history to be written, so I stopped 10 years ago to allow for some time for the histories to develop of the current era.
Mm-hmm. You say that there are four theories of American policy change that you seek to challenge in the book. Do you want to briefly outline what those are?
Well, sure. The first is a sort of category of theories that says that what's really important is the agenda. That is, we decide what problems we want to address, and then we debate what kinds of solutions there might be to those problems. And my argument against that is that what issues are high on the agenda really doesn't necessarily predict where we're actually going to get policy change. So we can decide we want to do something about guns in schools, but that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get anything out of it, and often we get policy change without much a change in what's on the agenda. The second is what I call macro politics, which is just the idea that we can pretty much predict policy from trends in elections, that Republicans or Democrats win, and trends in public opinion. Is it moving more liberal or conservative overall? And I show that that doesn't seem to be the case. Instead, we just had this period of extensive liberal policymaking in the 1960s and 1970s that stands out, but isn't directly predictable from elections and public opinion alone. And then the third theory is that there's a sort of a types of policy, and we can say, okay, there's some types where the public has a big influence. There's some types where that is mostly insider interest group negotiations. And I show that issue areas really don't fall neatly into those categories, and policymaking across all of these issue areas is predominantly insular. And then finally, I call these the sort of actor success ideas, and that's the idea that we can focus on one actor at a time. We can say, how successful is the president or members of Congress? And I show that you can't really focus on any one actor because the actors pretty much all have to be working together for anything of significance to happen.
And we probably focus, because it's easier for us to look at actors, that we tend to be a personality-driven society with television, et cetera. So we look at presidents or key figures in Washington and associate success or failure as a result of their actions. Let's start with them for a moment, and let's look at that civil rights period, 1964, 1968. You write some very interesting things that I really hadn't thought about, what happened in 1968 and how some policies that we would think of as liberal were continued. But to look at that time in history where we saw significant civil rights legislation, we tend to say, well, it was Lyndon Johnson, who was a powerhouse in the House and had all these contacts. But you say, you talk about the actors and several actors being really important, and they weren't all presidents. Some of them were Republicans. It was a real coalition of people that allowed sweeping change to happen in this field, would you say?
That's right. Well, first, it extended well beyond the 4 years that you mentioned. It goes clear into the 1970s, and the Richard Nixon, first Nixon administration, is actually the second most, I think, productive and liberal administration by policy output. So it really was a whole connected era that stretched beyond Johnson. But I don't think we can dismiss the extensive connections that Johnson did have to interest groups and legislators. I just point out that Kennedy and Nixon also had those same connections, and that what really was helpful to creating an era of productive policymaking was that there were lots of allied interest groups and legislators in lots of different policy areas. So it wasn't just civil rights. Civil rights is certainly a lot of civil rights policymaking during the era, but also quite a bit in environmental policy and all sorts of social welfare policy areas.
Let's go back to agenda for a moment. How is it determined what is going to be on the agenda? Why was it that President Obama focused on health care? Why is it that even after Sandy Hook, gun issues are not on the top of the agenda, even though the American public went through and continues to go through this great horror with guns, and yet it's not translated into any kind of policy? How do things get to the top of the agenda? Whose agenda?
Well, I think in large part it's determined by the policymakers themselves. They sometimes take cues from the public or the media, but not quite as often as we think. And then even when they do decide to address something, that doesn't mean we're actually going to get any results from it. And I think the key insight is that you really need an agreement on a policy proposal for anything to get done. You don't need an agreement to address a problem. That doesn't get you very far in a political system where a whole lot of people have to agree for anything to happen. So even if you see something momentarily rise, that doesn't mean you're going to get any results. And there's also just quite a few stories of successful policy change that occurs without much public attention, or that people don't even realize created significant policy until a few years later.
What about the idea, the president has been criticized for this, and much has been said, that you have different pieces of legislation depending on if you're blue states or red states in this country. The agenda, the issues are very different, and you have much more success. And perhaps the president should have followed a policy when he had the House and the Senate of pushing through everything that was on his agenda, the issues that he campaigned on. Is that a way to get policy in action, to have everybody on your side?
Well, it hasn't been the norm. I think that's what we think, is that you just need sort of unified Democratic control and a big election result, and then you're going to get a lot of policy. And that does happen. We do have examples of that, but it's not how policy change usually occurs. Policy changes, major policy changes, usually historically have passed with two-thirds votes and some bipartisan support. So it tends to develop over a much longer period with lots of involved interest groups and legislators. President Obama was able to implement health care reform and the stimulus package and several things on his election agenda in 2008, but hasn't been able to achieve as much in the sort of normal policymaking route. Of course, not wholly due to his own actions, but also due to nothing much happening in Congress.
Mm-hmm. So why was Obama able to achieve health care reform and Clinton was not?
Well, I think first of all, I wouldn't necessarily separate them, because we commonly see a long-term trajectory to policies where, even in the productive era, like the 1960s, we had reforms to federal housing policy, for example, that started in the Kennedy administration and weren't fully passed until the Ford administration. So, in some sense, the Obama initiative was a follow-on to the Clinton initiative and the initiatives going back all the way to Truman to get some changes in national health insurance. But I think the key success came from trying to organize a lot of interest groups on the same side, the AARP, many of the health insurance companies, to try to minimize objections by sort of bringing everyone on board, which, of course, has some costs in what the content of the policy ends up looking like. But politically, it's quite important to try to minimize objections and get everyone on board. Even though he had that unified interest group community, or almost unified interest group community, it, of course, still passed on party line votes.
For those who like to see government do a whole lot and address a lot of issues, this statement that you write in your book may be a little depressing. The most important system-level characteristic, you write, of American policymaking is pervasive status quo bias.
Right. So the bad news, if you want government to address more problems and to expand its scope, is that usually that's not what occurs. Usually, even if we discuss something for a while, we don't get any results from it. And that's not just a characteristic of the current era, but has been true throughout American history. The bad news, if you're on the side of wanting the government to do less rather than government to do more, is that when government does decide to do something, it usually expands its scope, and we hardly ever go back to the programs that we have already passed and shrink them or get rid of them.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, when we hear frequently from Republicans wanting to limit the size of government, that when we look at major policies that, as you have for the last 60 years, many of them would be considered a liberal expansion of the role of government.
Right, in the sense that they expand rather than contract the scope of government.
Mm-hmm.
So not necessarily matching the liberal ideal, but moving more towards expanded government focus rather than contracting government. So despite lots of calls for a smaller government that does less from Republican politicians, we really only had one two-year period right after the Republicans took over in 1994 where we had more government contractions passed than expansions. In Congress, and then even though we think of Reagan, for example, as leading over contraction of government, it was really only the first 2 years of his administration where the executive branch took on more new policies that contracted what they were doing than expanded it.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about special interest groups for a moment. Let's say you're a member. Let's give you a couple of groups. One, the NRA, and you're working tirelessly in terms of writing to members of Congress, talking about issues that may be considered, that may be on the table in years past. Two, you're a member of an environmental group, and you're trying to get stiff action on global warming in the world, and you want legislation passed. Are you saying then that your efforts in this regard are kind of a waste of time, or are they important in the whole policymaking process?
Well, at least historically, it has been more important that interest group leaderships endorse a legislation than it has been that they stimulate lots of mobilization on the part of individual voters. So I would say it's quite important to build institutions that help support certain policy proposals. It's just that there's quite a bit of stability in the system. So we see the very oldest, largest groups continually involved in policymaking. So if your concerns are within the sphere of the big, well-known interest groups, then you're in luck. If you're trying to start a new group to address a new set of concerns, it's much harder to influence the policy system.
You spend some time in the book talking about the AARP. They're a pretty successful group, aren't they?
Right. And certainly the national leadership of the AARP has been quite influential. The Bush administration essentially went to the AARP to ask what they could do to get support for the prescription drug bill in 2003 and got their endorsement and helped pass the legislation. And then the same thing happened in Obamacare, where the Obama administration went to them, asked what they could do to get support, made changes to the legislation, and helped the AARP help the bill get through. In both cases, the AARP faced some opposition from their internal membership that didn't want them to be taking that stance. But it really is the stance of the group leadership that makes a difference. And not necessarily the mobilization of individuals.
We welcome phone calls. Let me give you our phone number. This is the time of the hour that we start taking your calls. We're speaking with Matt Grossman. Matt has done this extraordinary study with a lot of hard work looking at American policymaking for a 60-year period of time and has written about all that influences public policymaking. Is it key actors involved in bringing together, in pushing their ideas and bringing together supporters? What about interest group people? What about influential people on Capitol Hill, be they from the Senate or the House, most likely the Senate? What about outside actors who may be looking at this? What about our whole system of checks and balances and how it may keep us from enacting significant policy in this country? Well, it looks at, and he just poured through all kinds of material, books, and he looked at the records of every individual, every organization that historians credit with policy change in this country. So it's quite a exhaustive work. Artists of the Possible, Governing Networks and American Policy Change Since 1945. We welcome phone calls for Matt. Matt Grossman is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Michigan State University and is also author of Not So Special Interests, Interest Groups, Public Representation, and American Governance. Here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, here's our phone number, and let me frame this in terms of think of an important piece of policy legislation that was important to you, and we can find out why it happened, or policy legislation that hasn't happened or didn't happen and why it didn't happen. 800-486-8655 is our number. John in Watertown is our first caller. Hey, John.
Hi. I guess, having been involved in local government and state government, and I've developed a model, it seems to me, that seems more realistic, that there's really kind of a privileged oligarchy running the show both on the local, state, and national levels. There's, you know, it varies which level you're talking about. But it seems like the privileged oligarchy tends to have the greatest influence and tends to get what they want more than anybody else. I was wondering what your guests thought of that.
Matt?
Well, certainly people of higher socioeconomic status and organizations and businesses have more influence on the process than ordinary citizens. It's not always the same people with the same interests. That is, there is a lot of negotiation and a lot of compromise along the way. But as the caller points out, that might be that might not detract from the fact that the end results tend to reflect those people who are most involved in the policy system and have the most influence.
Thank you very much, John, for the call. We have heard, Matt, and I wonder if you agree that this is the case, that we're in a period of time when Republicans and Democrats don't have dinner together, don't really talk to each other, their families don't associate with each other. I wonder if we make too much of the fact that in order to get policy enactment, you have to be able to get along with each other and socialize with each other and come on over for dinner.
I think political scientists have been too dismissive of those concerns. We certainly like to point out that people do fundamentally disagree on ideology and on issue priorities, and dinner parties are not going to change those disagreements. But I think we're wrong to completely dismiss the fact that back in more productive eras in Congress and the White House, you did have more social interaction. You did have folks that were there for a long time and knew each other across the aisle, and that did seem to make a difference, at least according to both political and policy historians, in terms of their ability to reach agreements.
Mm-hmm. What about media coverage? That certainly has changed in the period of time that you examined. Does it make a difference in terms of at least suggesting items for an agenda, if not putting them at the top of the list, or not?
Not very much. It's well down on the list based on what historians credit with bringing about policy change. So they're much more likely to mention things happening with long-serving senators, the president or administrators, or interest groups in lobbying in Washington. You don't get down to media influence until you're also considering research, international influence, state and local policymaking, lots of other factors that can occasionally matter, but don't seem to matter regularly. And what the media talks about is also not very correlated with where we actually see policy results. So the media also can't direct policymakers' attention to a problem and expect that they're going to see policy results as a result.
Mm-hmm. And again, continuing on the idea here of excessive partisanship, policy outcomes, you write, are not inevitable consequences of the partisan or ideological climate. You write about today's Republican Party being a very different animal than the one that confronted Johnson or was allied with Richard Nixon. So why not? Why wouldn't there be an inability to enact policy if you've got ideological drift, putting people very left, very right, not talking to each other? It would seem to me as though that's something new. It's not new, or it's not that important, or what?
It's certainly part of the story, and we have certainly seen increases in polarization and more divided government between Republicans and Democrats. But we also saw that, for example, from 1945 to 1960, we had very little polarization and still very little policymaking. So it isn't the case that if you lack polarization, you automatically get more policy change. And there just isn't much of a correlation between the degree of polarization between the parties and how much policy change we actually see. The big thing that stands out is just this very productive era in the 1960s through the mid-1970s. Certainly part of what made that era possible is that we had more liberal Republicans who were willing to be involved in policymaking and presidents like Nixon who were willing to make deals with Democrats. But that is certainly not the whole story, and the kind of policymaking that we see now, where not much happens in most issue areas, is certainly the norm.
We go to Kirk in Eau Claire. Hey, Kirk.
Thank you. I'm wondering, if you have noticed a correlation between the growth of the modern social welfare state, the bureaucratic state, correlating with the immense growth in what we have come to call the military-industrial complex, whether there's one reflects the other or there's some kind of correlation, cause and effect, whatever it might be, but they seem to go hand in hand. Have you checked that out?
Well, certainly government has been growing since 1945 across the board. If you look at it as a share of the total budget, you actually see those two things trading off quite a bit. So since the height of World War II, the military budget has become a smaller share of the total budget, and the social welfare budget has been increasing since the 1960s. But certainly it's the case that government has taken on more responsibilities over time and that we hardly ever reverse either of those trajectories, and when we do, it's usually short-lived, and we usually find something else for the government to take on. So in the military arena, we had a short-lived reduction after the end of the Cold War, but then we found through after 9/11 a massive expansion in the intelligence part of the budget, and then on social welfare, even as we have reduced it in some areas, like in welfare reform, we increased in other areas, like the earned income tax credit.
Thank you, Kirk, for your call. We're welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about policy coming from Washington and looking at it over a 60-year period of time. Our guest is Matt Grossman, author of Artists of the Possible, Governing Networks and American Policy Change Since 1945. Is it important actors? Is it cooperation? Is it the public agenda, what the people want? Is it special interest group? What is it that allows legislation to pass, policy to become policy? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and Earl in Medford is next. Hello, Earl.
Hello. Great topic. I would like to ask the guest about lobbyists like Grover Norquist, who have representatives and senators sign a pledge never to raise taxes in any legislation they're dealing with. Now, Norquist isn't representing me, but he is getting these representatives signed up in advance.
Right. So Norquist is certainly on the list of people who are accredited with significant policy changes and have a role in the policy process. And groups like Americans for Tax Reform can also be influential. One thing I would point out, though, is that he's usually in the place of rooting against new legislation. That is, he's trying to block changes like tax increases. He has been somewhat successful in stimulating new policies like tax cuts or tax reforms, but nowhere near as successful as he's been in blocking a new policy. So it's always easier to be against new policy change than to try to be rolling back existing policies. So Norquist has been able to prevent a lot of tax increases, though not all, and hasn't really made much progress in reforming the tax system as a whole by reducing loopholes and lowering the rates as a whole.
Hmm. Anything else, Earl?
Was this kind of action influential when the government kind of stopped working because they couldn't get any agreement on budget bills? Would that be a factor there?
Certainly, people's unwillingness to raise taxes prevents a deal between the two parties where we get tax increases and spending cuts. But in typical fashion, what eventually led to a compromise was a legislated prior deadline, the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, where we did eventually get some tax increases, even despite Republican opposition. So, yes, interest groups play a role, but when we do get policy change, it is often because other interest groups are for those policy changes and some kind of legislated deadline makes action much more likely.
Thanks, Earl, very much for the call. Let's spend a little time talking about long-serving members of Congress. You talk about long-serving members of Congress, prominent interest groups, presidents. Institutionalized entrepreneurs most often jointly produce policy enactments. So what is it? You have to be there for about 20 years. As they say, you have to be a teacher to be extraordinarily effective, to be at the peak of your profession.
Well, it's not only skill development, but also building connections over time. So you take a prominent actor like Ted Kennedy, who was involved in extensive policymaking over a very long period with multiple presidents from both political mm-hmm. parties. And a lot of the skill there wasn't just in developing policy, but in finding the right a compromise or the right coalition to get that policy through. So we're lacking in those kinds of successful leaders now, and we're especially lacking in people on the Republican side who want government to go into new areas and are willing to try to make compromises with Democrats to make that happen. So understandably, it's mostly liberals and Democrats who want to be involved in expanding the scope of government. But we used to have Republicans like Jacob Javits who served for a long time and were willing to make compromises with liberals.
Mm-hmm. Let's pick up a couple pieces in whatever areas you want, be it you look at agriculture, civil rights and liberties, criminal justice, education, energy, the environment, finance and commerce, health, housing and development, labor and immigration, macroeconomics, science and technology, social welfare and transportation. Pick whatever areas you want, and let's look at some pieces of policy that were highly controversial. We had heated arguments, but we did have a lot of compromise and significant pieces of legislation that gave us new policies. Do some easily come to mind?
I mean, I think one thing that I point out is that the issue areas don't differ as much into sort of types as people think. So you don't sort of have one insider kind of policymaking and one more public policymaking. Instead, you sort of have a universal policy process where presidents, members of Congress, and interest groups are negotiating to try to bring about policy changes. So take an area like education, where there's been an expansion of the federal government's role in education fairly constant since 1945. Major legislation passed in the 1960s enabled that big change, and then we've essentially been following up on that ever since. And most of the big changes, even ones that are controversial now, like No Child Left Behind, were the product of bipartisan compromises to expand the scope of government into new areas.
Mm-hmm. Even though I believe you remind us, was it 1996, the Republican platform called for disbanding the Department of Education?
Yeah, so you see a lot more rhetoric on the right about rolling back existing government programs and about one in seven major policy changes do result in contraction, but those are overwhelmed by the number that increase the scope of government. And you see a lot more rhetoric on the right than actual action to reduce the scope of government.
We go to John in Milwaukee. Hello, John.
Hello. I would say there's a lot of other things that are actually more important than pressure groups or lobbyists or to enact certain kinds of legislation. For instance, like the wars that are started by us antagonizing other countries, and suspicious murders of the president, like JFK, and then followed by the Vietnam War, and also the 9/11 attack, which was never investigated by Congress, what it should have been.
Yeah, I'm not sure. What are you getting at, John? I'm trying to tie it to our conversation.
There are people in government that will promote a war by antagonizing foreigners to attack us, and then saying, "Oh, we poor Americans have been attacked by those nasty."
Okay, thanks for your thoughts. They're a little bit off topic for this hour. This hour, we are speaking with the author of "Artists of the Possible: Governing Networks and American Policy Change Since 1945." Our guest has done an exhaustive study of the actors at play here who we can credit with at least one policy enactment and looked at what policies were enacted over that period of time, recording every individual and organization and looking at all of the different areas of domestic policy, identifying long-term trends and I guess one of the conclusions, I mean, I don't want to put it in a sentence because it's a very broad book, but that in most times there's little policy change that should be expected, that our system of government works against that, and things tend to happen over long periods of time.
Right. I did want to comment real quick on that. John mentioned that events matter a lot in the policy process, and that is something I track to see whether we sort of get an event like a school shooting or a war, and then we get policymaking in response to that. And that is something that is mentioned by policy historians, I think, for about 40% of all policy changes where they mention something related to events. It's overwhelmingly wars and economic recessions that promote policymaking in some areas. And they're not always directly related to that. So, for example, the Cold War was credited in part with the original Elementary and Secondary Education Act in the 60s. So you sometimes have spillover into other policy areas from ongoing events. But that's still less frequently important than interest group lobbying, at least according to policy historians.
All right. Thank you for responding. I was just having a hard time figuring out how to respond to that, but thank you. We welcome more phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So let's continue our conversation. Matt Grossman is with us this hour, Artist of the Possible, Governing Networks and American Policy Change Since 1945, is what we're talking about this hour. I think the number that stays in my mind, Matt, when you looked at notable policy enactments over the 60-year period of time was something like 790. Does that strike you as a huge number or a small number?
I guess it's not a huge number to me necessarily, but it does mean that you know, if you take an average, that we get 11 or so per year. It's just that the average doesn't tell you much because they're overwhelmingly concentrated in the 1960s and the 1970s. So most of the time we don't get very many policy changes, and then occasionally, at least once, we got a big burst in policymaking across all of the branches of government. So one other thing I look at is that most policy changes are laws passed by Congress and signed by the president, but there is also some important policymaking that takes place in the executive branch alone or in the courts. One thing that stuck out is that those two branches were also more productive in the 1960s through the 1970s.
And what about the role of the courts? We haven't talked about that very much. Are they responsible for a lot of policymaking?
Not a whole lot. I think it's on the order of 15% or so of policy changes that occurred on the courts. So, of course, most of the time when the courts make a decision, it's to sustain the law, so that wouldn't count as a policy change. But there are occasionally changes that are seen as just as influential as new laws that make it through the courts. One thing that I point out is the surprising connections between them. So you often see the same interest groups, for example, involved in policymaking in the legislature, and then later trying to expand the role of the laws that they helped pass in the courts, or working through the courts first and then working in the legislature once they achieve some success in the courts. So even though it seems like different branches acting independently, there's of course connections between them, and then there are actors that are using all of the branches to their advantage to try to change policy in their direction.
Not that we know exactly, because it was a long time ago, but do you think it was the vision of the founders, and it's one of the reasons that we have these three branches and this whole system of checks and balances, was to make sure that policymaking happened over deliberate conversation and perhaps many years instead of immediately?
Well, certainly institutions were supposed to check the passions of majorities or minorities that were trying to move policy in their direction, and our governing system does a good job of blocking changes and making sure that a policy is developed over a long period through established relationships and negotiations. On the downside, I would say that it's quite a bit more insular than the founders might have expected. That is, policymakers can become professionalized and have sort of a permanent voice in policymaking in Washington without much input from the public. So that may be seen as a little bit less expected.
There is something really demoralizing about that, which is important to the American public, not making its way into policy. Because isn't that what a democracy is about? We quoted Abraham Lincoln, and you have in the book, of the people, by the people, for the people, that it's supposed to be about us, isn't it?
Certainly, we have a lot of mythology around the public being the primary, having the primary role in government. But I don't think it's that surprising necessarily to most members of the public that usually their influence is not as pronounced as is the influence of major policymakers and interest groups. I would say it's demoralizing the extent to which there doesn't seem to be trends between either the problems that the public considers important or the general ideological direction that the public would like the government to take and the actual policy outputs that we see.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about guns again for a moment. After Newtown took place, everybody was pretty convinced that we would see at least background checks become law, and it did not happen. Can you tell me why it is? Let's talk about the NRA as an influence group for a moment and the power they may have. It has been explained, as you well know, that they have so much power and are giving so much money to members of Congress that it just is never going to be brought to the floor. We're not going to debate this issue. Why is it when you have public responding to an event like that and a continuing problem in American society that nothing makes its way? And this is true of other issues as well, but this one seems to be with us right now.
Well, I think the main reason is that sort of agreeing on the problem just doesn't necessarily get us to a solution. So the fact that a new school shooting happened does not necessarily change anyone's opinion about what kind of policy would prevent it, even if it increases our attention to the problem at the moment. That doesn't mean, you know, we have seen cases where school shootings resulted in some policy changes, but this was the norm, where what happened was you got a series of insignificant executive orders, which is kind of the common type of response to this sort of event, where you didn't get any major policy change. Mm-hmm. I guess one thing I would say is that people often point to the money, but the money is not necessarily enough. And in fact, you have now, for example, Mike Bloomberg willing to spend quite a bit of money to oppose the NRA. And I don't think that that's going to be enough, because the NRA has this established position as the representative of a big constituency that cares most about that issue. And so their voice is likely to be heard on this issue, and what their leadership wants is going to have a big role in the policy process.
You mentioned, Matt, executive order. Are we seeing more and more of that these days? Because that's something you can pretty much do by yourself, right?
Yeah, not necessarily a big increase. We do see some changes over the sort of the course of administrations, but in terms of significant policy changes, you know, not very many of them occur through executive order. You do occasionally see one. You see some also through agency rules. So sometimes you do get changes in the bureaucracy alone, but we haven't seen a big increase in them. And there doesn't seem to be much of a correlation between when Congress is acting and when the executive branch is acting, so you don't see the executive branch taking over when Congress isn't doing much. One other quick point about the NRA is that most of their success is in opposing new policy, and so that is a constant factor in American policy. I think Marty Gillen's collected a lot of data on all of their positions, and they had, I think, taken positions against several hundred policies, and they'd had an 80% success rate in blocking them, but they'd only voiced support for four of the policies that he looked at, and they got two of them and didn't get two of them. Mm. So, you know, most of their success is in blocking policy change, and it's certainly a lot easier for actors that want nothing to happen compared to those actors that want new policy.
Mm. And I'm wondering what the role of just hard, day after day, sometimes year after year work is in all of this. You mentioned workhorses in the Senate. I think you described Ted Kennedy as a workhorse. How important is that, just staying with it and working hard on it?
I think it's very important. I don't think, though, that it's necessarily issue-specific expertise. So some people in the past have thought, well, what you need to do is be the person that's steeped and knows everything about transportation policy and be the expert there. But the people that we see as most influential in policy history are people who are generalists, who established reputations for knowing the policy details, but also knowing the political compromises and having the relationships to get those policy changes through. So Ted Kennedy has been a giant of education policy, of immigration policy, of social welfare policy, pretty much across the board, and the same was true of Lyndon Johnson. So some of our most prominent actors are certainly workhorses, but they're not necessarily issue specialists.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, as a political scientist, when you look at where the most significant and long-lasting and perhaps important policy has come from, are we looking at divided government, president of one party, House and Senate perhaps of another, or House and Senate divided, or does it, getting back to something we talked about earlier, do we get it from unified all of the same party?
Well, I don't find much of a correlation between between whether the same party controls Congress and the White House and how much significant policy change we get. There is a bit of controversy in political science about this issue. Some people do find that divided government reduces output. I would just emphasize that even those who do find that it reduces output don't find a consistent relationship, and they don't find necessarily a very large one. So we certainly saw periods like in the 1970s where Nixon was president, the Democrats controlled Congress, where we saw a whole lot of policymaking. So divided government is not necessarily a sign that no policy will take place.
Mm-hmm. And we tend, that's the year that I forget about. You make mention of that in the book, that we had Johnson for a number of years in all of this policy, but it didn't really end in 1968. It was carried on by Nixon.
Right, until the mid-1970s, we had extensive policymaking, and it was liberal, at least for the early 1970s, so all the major environmental statutes, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We did then see a shift toward more conservative lawmaking in the late 1970s. Interestingly, it people think it sort of corresponded with Reagan's rise in 1981, but it was occurring before then, and seems instead to have actually coincided with the liberal takeover in the House of Representatives following the Watergate elections and the election of Carter.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't, again, match the easy Republican-Democrat types of policymaking.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for being with us and for all of the work on this. It's really remarkable. Just a final minute on where we stand now. Do you see any significant change in where we've been historically when it comes to policymaking? And can you give us any prediction for the next few years?
Well, the best prediction is always that not much is going to happen. That doesn't mean nothing. So we still see some significant policymaking. We had the Data Act passed, which will open federal government data in more agencies. In the last part of the first Obama administration, we had a new microfinance policy that actually Eric Cantor and Obama jointly helped enact. So we occasionally still get some policies, but they're certainly rare. And the norm is for not much to happen in most issue areas.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Our guest this hour, Matt Grossman. Matt's latest book is Artists of the Possible, Governing Networks and American Policy Change Since 1945. Matt is Associate Professor of Political Science at Michigan State University. He works on American politics and policymaking, interest group representation and influence, political networks, campaigns, federal policy change in the U.S. His current coursework includes teaching on political parties and interest groups. And his first book was The Not-So-Special Interests, Interest Groups, Public Representation, and American Governance. We thank him for his expertise talking about who policymakers listen to and why it is that certain things become laws and certain things do not. Fascinating read. A lot of work in that book. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing The Hour, and thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We're going to be talking about those boomerang kids. Hour two of our show. If you are one, you can tell us why you are. Maybe it's not such a bad thing. We'll find out.